WBF FX Radio. You're on the Commons. I'm Shu Bartholomew. And joining me on the Commons today is Georgia Houghton. Georgia is an author with her brand new book that is just off the presses, and it's called Under Mushroom Clouds, and you'll never guess what she talks about. That's right. She talks about homeowner associations, and she talks a little bit about her own experiences in her own homeowners association. Plus, she has some ideas and observations, and she has very graciously agreed to join us today and to talk to us about it. Georgia, thanks so much for joining us.
I'm delighted to be joining you, Shu.
First of all, before we even get started on here, can we give the listeners a way of getting in touch with you? Do you have an email address?
Yes, I do have an email address.
Okay.
The email address is georgia5_2002@hotmail.com.
So you want to do that again, just in case? And we'll give it again later on. But
okay, yes. It's georgia5_2002@hotmail.com.
Okay. Now, your book is called Under Mushroom Clouds, Homeowners versus Homeowner Associations. That's kind of an intriguing title. You want to tell us how you arrived at that?
Yeah, I can tell you how I arrived at that. We were having a number of problems within our association, and one of my neighbors came by one day and said that he had heard the president of our association say, this is going to be a big mushroom cloud. And this neighbor came over to me and he said, what was he talking about? What did he mean by mushroom cloud? And I hadn't the slightest idea, but then I got searching around on the internet and I came up with the use of this expression used by directors of homeowners associations, apparently, to sort of say, let's keep the members of the association in the dark. We'll keep them under a mushroom cloud and feed them manure. And I thought, and then that's exactly what's happening in our association. We, as members, were being kept in the dark, and we were being fed a lot of misinformation. And it just clicked for me as a title of what's really going on.
But, you know, you've got some delightful graphics in the book. Are you also the artist?
No, Nanette Scove is the artist. The sketches, the topics for the sketches were my idea, but Nanette was the skillful artist who could put those together for me.
Well, I've got to tell you, if you look at the book, folks, you've got a picture of a person, and I think it must be a man, just hanging on to his ears, his head, and he's got his head down. But behind him is this cloud. I mean, it almost could look like an atomic blast. And that's what I thought of when I first saw the picture, was it was an atomic blast, which would also, you know, work really well because, hey, what we're dealing with is we've just taken conventional housing and just blown it into smithereens.
That's true. That's very true. And the picture depicts the despair of this person because he seemingly has no defense against what is happening to him.
So he's pretty much on his own trying to figure all of this out.
Mm-hmm.
Why did you write the book? Okay, first of all, this is not your first book.
No, that's correct. I've written a book called Introduction to Resort Management some years ago. I have taught resort management on the college level, most recently actually in Latvia with the Peace Corps. But I wrote this book because of a growing frustration in terms of getting the word out to people as to what's really going on. I myself was not fully aware of what was going on until I got drafted to be on our board, and I think the people who drafted me to be on the board have since regretted that choice.
So you're not one of those people who sort of found themselves in the crosshairs of the association, just being abused and harassed and threatened, and so you're just fighting back. You actually got involved in this from a very pleasant standpoint, in that you were invited to be a part of the board.
And Yeah, that's correct. I was invited to be a part of the board, and interestingly enough, there were sort of two political fractions on the board at that time, and both sides wanted me to be president of the association. That ended rather quickly when they realized I wasn't going to be the pawn of either side.
So you went onto the board with absolutely no real knowledge of what an association's all about, right?
I didn't have much knowledge of it, no. I was under the misconception of the myth that's out there that homeowners associations are a great idea. They'll protect your property values and all this sort of nonsense, and have since come to realize, well, that's not exactly true.
So you don't think they protect your property values?
No, I don't. As I see it from the perspective here and perspective of owning a condominium in Florida not too long ago, I see property values as having very little to do with homeowners associations. They have much more to do with outside economic forces and what's happening in adjacent neighborhoods. But also, I've owned seven different homes in my lifetime, and the ones that I owned that were independent, I was able to make a really nice profit on because I was able to do with what I wanted to improve them. Within a homeowners association, that's simply not possible. And in fact, on the homeowner association properties I've owned, I have not made a profit.
Oh, really?
Right.
So you've never made a profit on a controlled house?
No, I have not. In fact, I have lost money on two of them. And if I had to sell the one that I'm in now, I would probably be lucky if I broke even.
You're not exactly in a large metropolitan area, are you?
No. Green Valley is a retirement community 20 miles south of Tucson, not too far from the Mexican border.
So is there any, I mean, we hear that you need associations because you've got large metropolitan areas like where I am, which is Washington, D.C., New York, Chicago, Phoenix, Los Angeles, Miami, all of these major large cities, and because the suburbs cannot handle, the number of people that they're increasing density and, you know, they need, and the suburbs and the local municipal governments cannot handle it, the local jurisdictions, so they're financially sort of shunting their responsibility onto the private sector, but there's really no real reason for you, where you are, to be basically saddled with another layer of government.
That's an interesting observation, and I would say that the reason that it's happening in this area, and it's happening large scale all across Arizona, particularly between Phoenix and Tucson, but also here south of Tucson, developers are coming in, and what has happened is that the developers have gotten basically the legislative support that they need to just go ahead and get the right to build high-density housing with the guarantee that they'll keep some of it as open common land, something that is really not necessary. It's true. There are near here some private acreage that's available that people could build on, but what's happened is that the developers are just eager to go with this, and they're putting up these fancy fronts of super recreational facilities, and they're conning people into saying, come live in this paradise where you won't have to even take care of your own yard, we're going to do it for you, and so on and so forth. And what's happened is that the average buyer doesn't realize the ultimate cost of this to him.
So basically, it's sort of selling a lifestyle and carefree living.
That's right. That's right. A lifestyle and carefree living until they get here and they realize that carefree living is, first of all, it's not that carefree, and secondly, it's terribly expensive.
So, well, the affordable housing is yet another issue, and we'll
probably... It's part of the illusion, because the affordable housing, especially out here in Arizona, where the state law permits assessments to go up by as much as 20% a year, within our association, they can go up as much as 10% a year, and there is no reason for them to go up. For example, in our association, we had a surplus of operating budget last year, but for the last 3 years, the board has raised assessments by 10% every single year. And so pretty soon, you've got people here, many of them living on a fixed income. They're simply not going to be able to afford the assessments, and they're going to have to move out. We're actually creating a new class of homeless.
I'm sorry, say that again?
We're actually creating a new class of homeless because
homeless
people cannot, you see, when they come into these places, they are conned into what a great deal it is. They are not fully apprised of the cost to them down the line of maintaining these wonderful recreational facilities that they, or even the common land washes between the houses and so forth, all of which have to be maintained now at the expense of the association members rather than the county government.
You know, you had a number of interesting observations in your book. We talked a little bit about assessments and the increases. I mean, they can be runaway increases in terms of what the association can get away with. 10% in this day and age, when the average increase, cost of living increase, is like 2% and 3%.
That's correct.
You know, you compound that over 5 years. That's a fair chunk of money.
Yeah, it's really forcing some of the people that live. The association that I live in is a mid-range to lower-range price setting in terms of what's going on in this development area. In this development area, we have some associations where properties are literally, condominiums are literally selling for less than $30,000, though the good market price on these is around $45,000. But then we've got other properties that are coming in the $300,000, $400,000 range. And what's happening is that people are buying in often at what they consider a comfortable limit at that time. Yeah, I can afford this house, I can afford the assessment dues that they're telling me that I have, but they're not being told that if they go up by 10 or 20% every year, and it's just going to be a whole different ballgame, and they're not going to be able to afford it.
Well, that's only...
They don't usually realize either that they're going to be doubly taxed. They're going to have to pay this assessment to the association, but they also have to pay normal property taxes.
I think that's a point that people are beginning to, you know, to understand. But, you know, you're talking about normal assessments going up 10, 12, 15, 20%. According to Arizona statute, and people on fixed incomes coming in are not really aware of it. And so I guess that comes back to, you know, what you said earlier about creating another class of homeless.
That's correct. And what's happened in Arizona since 1996, when a state law came into effect which allowed non-judicial foreclosures on properties for liens, is that the foreclosure rate has just gone up and up and up. And the other thing that's happening is that realtors, of course, are watching very carefully for properties that might come on the market at a good buy. They're tending to buy them up and then resell them quickly at to investors. And so you're getting more and more, especially in some of these lower-income associations, more and more rental properties, and over time, that doesn't serve the best interest of property values either.
So what you're saying is, let me understand this, you're in a retirement, basically a retirement area where a lot of people are living on fixed incomes. They're coming in, buying condos and units in associations, believing that their property values are going to be protected. They're not aware that that the assessments are going to go up dramatically. But we didn't even talk about special assessments. We talked about just the regular assessment going up 10%, maybe even up to 20% a year, right?
Right, that's correct. Yeah, then there's, on top of that, there are special assessments that the board can put into effect. That in many associations, for any special assessment to go there or to be put in place, it perhaps as much as two-thirds of the association would have to vote for that. But what happens is that the association, the board of directors of an association, can spend almost or perhaps all and even more than what they actually have available. They can spend down any reserve monies they have to virtually zero. Then you get to a situation where the only way to continue to maintain or improve your common areas would be by special assessment. When you get to that stage, it's not too hard to get two-thirds of the members to say, well, yeah, we do have to keep the rec center open, and if the only way we can do it is by special assessment, I guess we have to vote for that. Also, when things are voted on, usually the information put out to the members is one-sided, usually, of course, in favor of the assessment. The opposite side rarely gets any press.
So there's no real discussion, and you don't have the two sides. But before we go a whole lot further, I kind of want to follow the earlier train of thought, where we had people of limited income, fixed incomes, buying in, facing all of these increases, and then finding themselves in financial trouble. You talked about foreclosure. You also talked about realtors sort of keeping track of what's going on. Are there a number of, say, distressed sales, for instance, if you're sitting there and you just got hit with another increase and there's no way that you can make it, and you're facing foreclosure, and a realtor comes and says, I'll buy it from you in as-is condition at below market value.
Yeah.
Is that what you're saying is happening right now?
Yeah, that is happening to a certain extent. And I have not been able to trace out the figures on foreclosures. I know that they are way up since 1996, but the exact figures are very difficult to come by because the foreclosure process is what they call a non-judicial foreclosure.
Right.
Which simply means there's no court record on it.
That's right. That's absolutely right. There's, and I don't know if you ran into this in your, when you were doing all your research, but there's a website out of Houston, Texas, called hoadata.org, and they list the foreclosures. Now, I've talked to them, and, I know the lady who's done it, and her son's an attorney, and when I had him on the show, he said that they have, that's just the tip of the iceberg, because there's no way of being able to track the non-judicial foreclosures. He thought he had found a way, and his initial discovery said that the numbers were infinite. The stuff they've got on the web is just peanuts compared to what's going on. But when you've got non-judicial foreclosures, there are no records. There's no way of finding out what happened unless you know the address. And you can go in and look it up under the address, which makes it a very tedious process.
Yeah, and how you even get to that address in the first place. Shu, could you repeat that?
The website?
That website, yes.
Yes, it's hoadata.org. hoadata.org.
Okay.
And these are the foreclosures out of Harris County only, out of Houston, which is where Houston is. These are Harris County, and they're only the judicial foreclosures.
Right, and most of the foreclosures are not judicial. So in Green Valley here, I've just recently heard that there may be as many as 25% of the community who are living under the poverty level. And they're living in these condos and townhouses that they could afford when they moved in, but 5-10 years later, they can't afford them anymore.
You know, I've got so many notes here. I was jotting things down as I read your book. Your association in particular had a rather unique and creative way of dealing with their responsibility to maintain some of the common area. You want to tell us a little bit about that? I'm talking about the driveways.
Oh, yes. The common areas include what are called cul-de-sacs, though actually they're more properly called circular drives, that serve as few as 6 townhouses or as many as 14 townhouses. That's all common area. And the association, in fact, its agreement with the county when the developer got the original plans approved, is supposed to take care of these this common area. Now, in our particular association, fewer than 50% of us live in townhouses. The rest are all freestanding houses. So we already have a split within the community. But the some of the members of the board decided, well, let's split our responsibility here up a little bit further, because 70 of the 207 townhouses have direct access to a county street rather than being on one of these circular drives. And so they said, well, to these 70 people, we will offer them the chance to acquire their so-called front yard, their driveway to the street, plus a little bit of other common land in front of their front walls. We'll let them acquire that by quitclaim deed. That way, we will absolve ourselves of responsibility for taking care of this common area. And underneath it is the subtext that we'll also split the townhouse group up a little bit further. So we're weakening the position of a minority group even further. And it's interesting because 70 townhouses were eligible for this. To the best of my knowledge, only 30 have actually taken advantage of it. And there may be some real question on the county level as to whether or not it's even legal to sell common land to individual owners. So we've got a mess here that is an interesting challenge at the moment.
So you've got a county that decided, hey, we don't really want to take care of this property. So, Mr. Builder, if you're going to build this development, we highly recommend that you put in an association and you make them responsible for what we otherwise would have to do with our tax money, right?
That's correct.
So then you've got someone on a fixed income who comes in and buys, pays taxes, then has to pay assessments to get essentially the same services.
That's correct. They're paying for it twice.
And then the association decides, gee, well, we really don't want to be saving money and handling this. So guess what? We'll just quit claim this. It was a $10 fee, right?
That's right.
So, you know, now you get to own your driveway, but instead of us maintaining it, now you're responsible. And, of course, you're going to have to maintain it according to our standards.
Right.
And so now you've got someone paying twice for something and then still having to pay for it again a third time, right?
That's correct. That's correct. You've got it.
And this is affordable housing?
Yeah, this is supposed to be affordable housing, right?
And carefree living?
Yeah. You've got it. You've got it. And what's happening is that what the association is essentially saying is, well, we don't have the money to properly maintain these common areas we're supposed to maintain, so let's say that we can't do it and put it off on the individual members. And furthermore, if you were to turn that around and an individual member would say, well, I can't maintain my property, I can't paint the outside of my house the way I should because I don't have the money, well, hey, that doesn't fly. You're going to get a penalty, you're going to get legal fees, you're going to get all kinds of things. You, the owner, must live up to the agreements of your CC&Rs, but the association board doesn't have to.
So you pay taxes, you pay assessments, you then get stuck with the maintenance fees, and then you get fined if they're not maintained according to somebody's idea of how they're supposed
somebody's
to be maintained.
Somebody's idea, exactly.
And then you get slapped with legal fees
right.
and fines.
Right.
Oh. I can't wait to move over there.
A lot of people can't wait to move out, but we don't have any choices nearby.
We don't have any choices over here. We have the mandates. But, folks, you know, I think for those of you listening, I think Georgia has painted a very good, an excellent picture. She's taken us from step one, step two, and just shown us exactly the fallacy of this this whole thing. We're going to be taking a break in a few minutes, but before we do, there was another point that you raised in your book that I'd like to talk about, Georgia, and that is, you know, when we started off the program, we talked about having an association to provide us with amenities, recreational facilities, amenities, and protect property values. Yet in your book, you talk about the pool use, only 18%.
Yeah, there are very, very few people who actually use this. And what I've discovered in talking with other people who live in associations in this part of the country, but what I've also seen in the associations that I was associated with in Florida, is that you have all these lovely swimming pools and gardens and meeting rooms and so on and so forth. Everybody thinks, well, that's great. It's like I'm going to have all these country club amenities available to me. But in actual fact, over a period of time, they are used less and less. And also what happens is you almost get a click group coming in, and they sort of have fun using these. But then the relative outsider, it feels uncomfortable coming into them. So it's a weird sort of thing. And on the surface of it, it looks super. And in actuality, people are again and again saying, hey, I don't care about the rec center. They cared about it, or they thought they cared about it when they bought in because it looked so pretty. But in fact, in terms of their actual usage of it, it's minimal.
So if we were to take your number of 18% of the members who actually use the pool, you have a situation where 82% of the residents are subsidizing.
That's correct.
Subsidizing something, and this is again affordable housing and property values and all of that wonderful stuff, right?
Yeah, and we're also subsidizing the public parks in Tucson and things like that. So again, it's double taxation.
So why are we buying into them?
Because we have no choices. The affordable housing in this area, that's it. I talked to a realtor recently and said, you know, find me something where there is no homeowners association. And she called me back a week later and said, well, you know, their monthly payments up here are only $12 a month. And I said, hey, wait a minute. I want something that's not in an association. That realtor never called me back.
Oh, really?
Right. There are very, very, very few choices, and the choices that are there tend to be quite expensive.
So, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll sort of find out what else Georgia has observed during this period. So don't go away. We're talking to Georgia Houghton, who's written a book called Under Mushroom Clouds, Homeowners versus Homeowner Associations. And if you want to contact Georgia, her email address is georgia5_2002@hotmail.com, right?
That's correct.
And don't go away, because we'll be right back in a couple of minutes.
Bought my dream home to enjoy retirement life. I've made new friends and buddies, lots of parties for my wife. It seemed that life was perfect, all my neighbors felt the same. Then along came death by CCRs, life's over, I'm fair game. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why.
Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell.
WBR Fairfax Radio, you're on the Commons. I'm Sue Bartholomew. And on the Commons with us today, we have Georgia Houghton. Georgia is the author of a brand new book that's hot off the presses. It just came out, what, a couple of weeks ago, Georgia?
It came out at the end of February.
That's, end of February, okay.
Yes.
Under Mushroom Clouds, Time Flies. I've had it for that long, huh?
Yep.
Homeowners versus Homeowner Associations by Georgia Houghton. And Georgia's book basically talks a little bit about her own experiences, but she's got a lot of really interesting observations. And Georgia, what else? You know, we touched a little bit on foreclosures. But in your book, and I want to get this out before spending too much more time on that. In your book, you talk about board members saying things like, let's get him, we can foreclose. Do you think it's a power that's abused?
Oh, yes, it's definitely abused. And it's certainly, in any association, you've got some good board members who are really concerned about the membership. But what you have with the basic structure of a homeowners association is you have what I call a reporting community rather than a supporting community. The whole concept is based on report your neighbor if they do something wrong. And then if you don't like somebody, if there's any personal antagonism, if you have any access to the board at all, you have the power to go after this individual. That's typical of a dictatorial police state. We should have, well, we ought to be enjoying, especially of those of us who are now in retirement, but also younger people who are working, single moms and any family. You ought to be in a community that is supportive and friendly. I mean, that's what the great tradition of American communities is all about. You all get together and you join the volunteer fire department. You all get together and help each other out. But that's not what happens in these associations. You've got reporting communities. If somebody left their garbage can out overnight, report that person. If somebody's parking where they're not supposed to be parking, report that person. And it's just a tragic, tragic kind of situation.
It's sort of a great departure from the old traditional community, where I think what you were describing initially was where people were all part, and you know, they were neighbors and they were friends, and they looked out for each other.
That's right.
That's right.
And now they're looking out, but not the way they're supposed to be, right?
Yeah, they're looking out for what somebody's doing they think isn't right. They're looking out for their own personal views and things like this. I mean, it's incredible what's really happened. And, you know, talking about property values, traditionally, and this was my experience with the individual homes that I owned, it was always a matter of, you know, sort of wanting to keep up with the Joneses or improve your own property so that when you did sell it, you could do it at a profit. But within associations, you can't even paint your door without first getting permission, and then only the colors that they will permit. In my association, turquoise is okay, but forest green is not. It's crazy.
Yeah, it's, you know, here you are an adult and you buy your own house and then you have to get permission. But would you think it would be fair to say that associations actually promote intolerance?
Yes, I would. And I think if you go back into the history of them, they're not too different from country clubs, in the private country clubs, in the sense that what people were doing is they wanted to buy into an exclusive community. And associations certainly, for the most part, don't understand the value of diversity, the value of integration. And yes, they do promote intolerance, both within their own communities and toward the outside world.
Yeah, that's something that I've kind of been thinking. I think that, you know, the minute you have an association where you have, as you call them, and I really like that, reporting committees.
Right.
You've sort of created two classes of people. You know, those who do the reporting and those who get reported on, basically.
Well, yes, and but also you encourage people. One of my friends here said, you know, I used to report people because I thought that's what we were supposed to do, and now I'm somewhat ashamed of what I did because, you know, I'm not that kind of a person. And we had a situation in my immediate neighborhood where one neighbor was upset about the fact that the immediately adjoining property had a lot of debris that was needed to be picked up and taken off to the dump. And this lady was in her 80s, and she was not able to do it herself. And he wanted that reported because I was on the board, he told me, to in turn. And I said to him, wait a minute, let's go talk to this lady and get her permission to clean it up for her. And we did it, and everybody was happy about it. But that's not the typical pattern.
Yeah, it isn't. And that's really sad because what you just described, again, is community. And no matter how, I mean, I refuse to use that word in association with associations.
Right.
Because, you know, it's an oxymoron.
Yeah.
The minute you have an association, there is no community.
That's correct.
Any sense of community.
That's correct.
And yet everybody's running around, oh, these community associations. No, yeah. No. You know, you don't use those two words in the same sentence. They don't work.
Yeah, that's a good point.
They just don't work. Another observation we talked about, that you talked about, is that the police don't get involved. Now, this goes back to you pay your taxes, you pay for the police department, and you have a problem in an association, whether it's vandalism, you know, no matter what, even in some cases criminal activity, you call the police and they say
we don't get involved in homeowner disputes. Now, in this particular case that I'm referring to in the book, it was a homeowner having an argument about to get into physical confrontation with a handyman working in a neighbor's property. And this handyman was also working on county property at the time that the association member called me to come up and see what. And when I introduced myself to the handyman as a director and wanted to ask him what was going on, he was very confrontational to me. He said, get out of my way. I've got to get this work done. And he wouldn't talk to me. So at that point, I suggested that we call 911 and get some help. And the 911 sheriff's department did arrive quite quickly. However, the minute the sheriff from the sheriff's department stepped out of his car, he said, well, we don't get involved in homeowners association disputes. And I pointed out to him, this particular moment, we're on county property. And at that point, he did agree to step in. And in fact, shortly thereafter, just a few minutes thereafter, he called for backup and arrested the handyman.
So, but if you hadn't pointed out that you were actually standing
on county property, he would have just gone away. And it was a situation so tough that he called for backup.
Wow. I mean, that's something that we're running into all over the place. The police say, oh, well, private property, we just cannot get involved.
Yeah, right.
So that was county property. There are so many little tidbits sentences that I picked up and copied down and wrote. But you also, while we're still talking about community, you made the observation that CCNRs, which are covenants, conditions, and restrictions, this forms the basis of the contractual relationship that is so revered by people who advocate controlled living. But you made the observation that CCNRs should protect the residents and limit the powers of the board.
Yes, that's correct. And what I've found in looking at CCNRs, not only of our own association rather in depth, but also at several other associations and then just the research on this, has led me to realize that these contract agreements, the CCNRs, first of all, they protect the board. They do not protect the individual members. And if there's any violation of the CCNRs, the board frequently does that with impunity, because they know that in most cases a individual member will not have the resources or the time of money or time to go after them in terms of their breaking the contract agreement. So it's a very strange contract, because it can be changed by the board with added rules and so on and so forth, almost at will, but the individual on the other side, the homeowner, can't change the CCNRs. In fact, he'd have to get two-thirds of the members, some cases even more than that, to change the CCNRs. Furthermore, the CCNRs are in many cases documents of over 100 pages of legalese, and the homeowner is supposed to have read and understood and signed off on that as agreeing to that contract when he buys his house. He hasn't the slightest idea what he's signing off on. If you ask two different lawyers for an interpretation on any point, you might get two very different opinions as to what is meant. So the whole CCNR thing, and what most homeowners don't realize is that once the developer is out of the way and your association is older now and you're really just dealing with your own members, this contract agreement can be totally rewritten as a contract agreement amongst those of you who are now members of this association. And so what I've done, and it's in the book, is I've rewritten ours, which are 40 or 50 pages, in 3 pages of plain English. And you know, the people that have looked at it, I haven't shown it that widely around yet, but they love it. However, the board members do not, because it puts responsibilities on them and it gives rights to the members. And they don't like that.
Well, what you said, you know, that sounds kind of like the Bill of Rights, where you're actually protecting the members. And, you know, when you live in an association, you leave the American zone.
Yeah.
At least that's what we start the show off with every week. We're talking to Georgia Houghton, author of the brand new book, Under Mushroom Clouds, Homeowners versus Homeowner Associations. And if you'd like to contact Georgia, her email address is Georgia5_2002@hotmail.com. Georgia, I want to go back to age restrictions, because you talk about your particular neighborhood being sort of age restricted.
That's correct.
Now, did I read someplace where the age was, in the original documents, was 40? And
that's
was,
also correct.
And what happens if, okay, what happened? Did the board officially change it, or did the homeowners change it from 40 to 55? Or?
Yes, and going back through our records, I'm not sure exactly how that happened, whether that was actually a two-thirds vote, or whether it was simply a board decision, but at some point in our association, the age restriction was changed from 40 to 55. This has happened in other associations, one up in Tucson, for example. The original restriction was 40, and then it was up to 55. And what is happening in this particular area right now is that most of the Green Valley retirement communities, the age restriction is 55. That is shifting. That is shifting, and there are some new associations coming in, very upscale in terms of property values, starting at $300,000, $400,000. But they will, they may not be age restricted. And so what I say with regard to property values being affected by outside things, if you've got a non-age-restricted community coming in next to an age-restricted community, in this one case right now, you're going to have school buses driving through an age-restricted community to get to the non-age-restricted community, and people are getting uptight about that. And when people get uptight about what's happening in their neighborhoods, they tend to start selling, and there goes your property value.
Okay, just before, you know, I'm not an attorney, but it occurs to me that the having changed it from 40 to 55 may have to do with complying with federal fair housing laws.
Yes.
And so maybe that's one of the things. But But what happens to someone who buys in, for instance, you know, the governing documents say you have to be 40, so you're 40, and 5 years down the road, they change it to 55, and you're 10 years away from 55.
That's a good question, and there is perhaps some leeway there in that I believe the Federal Fair Housing Law says that 80 or 85% of your community must meet this for you to qualify as an age-restricted community. So you would have a little bit of leeway there for some of your people. But I don't know exactly how far that goes, and I'm not even sure what the federal guidelines are for enforcing that. I do know that we are asked to sign off each year saying that some member of our household is 55.
Each individual household, each individual unit has to sign off on that?
Yeah, has to be some record in their association office that want each, but we know that the board has made an exception in at least one specific case, and that, in my mind, sort of throws the whole thing up to possible legal action, because how can you make an exception? And what right has the board to make an exception to this 55 restriction?
You also commented, it's an observation that you made, but people who are 55, you know, they've worked all their lives, or people who are retired or over 55 have basically worked all their lives, and, you know, they're looking forward to just relaxing. I mean, they really and truly are looking forward to the carefree living, and yet they're being asked to put up with this nonsense. I mean, you've got someone deciding that they need to pull the weeds, trim the grass, paint their door, wash their windows, and serve on the board and serve on these reporting committees. And you had a whole slew of committees listed in your book. That, I mean, I'll be honest with you, I haven't heard of half of these. you must have more committees than just about everybody out there. But do people who are retired want to spend their time doing this?
No. And so what happens is many good people have been on boards, and they, once they're off, they say never again, and many quit before they even finish out an elected term. So what happens is you get a few literally power-hungry people who want to be in there, and because they want to control things, and they are usually not qualified to do it. They don't know basic accounting in many cases. They don't know how to read a contract, so when they go out and hire a management company, this hasn't happened in our association, but it's happened in some of the others, the officer from the organization, from the association, who has to sign off on that contract is not qualified to sign off on that contract. And, of course, the contracts are written by the management companies.
Well, you were funny because you said that the qualified managers were the ones who had, for instance, these things from CAI, and you obviously are not impressed with CAI.
No, definitely not.
So my hat's off to you for seeing through all of that. But it was so funny because you said, oh, he qualified because he slept through a CAI seminar.
I've gone to some of the CAI seminars. The first one with some hope that I might get something useful. But since then, I've gone to a couple of others just because I find them so amusing and so artificial.
So you're not really impressed. And so you don't think that anybody with a CCAM, a PCAM, or a DCAM is going to do much for you, huh?
No, definitely not. Definitely not. And you see, in Arizona, you've got the association business is the biggest business in the state, and there is no oversight by the government at all. Not at all. Contractors, there is an oversight on them. Realtors, there is an oversight, government oversight on them. But nothing for the biggest business in the state, Association.
Will you talk a little bit about the legislature? And, of course, your book came out before this particular legislative session was over with. And there have been a couple of attempts by Eddie Farnsworth in Arizona to curtail this crazy...
That had just recently virtually been torn apart and shot down by the CAI.
Right. So that's not going anywhere, but you don't think that the answer is in legislation, do you?
Well, the answer is that the legislation has to be out there, because if you don't have legislation to protect, for example, when I write a letter to the state attorney general and I get back from him, well, I'm concerned about your problems, but we have no power because there's no legislation to act under. So legislation does have to change.
So you're looking at starting at the legislative arena here and coming up with more homeowner-friendly legislation, actually legislation that protects the individual, right?
Yes, definitely. Legislation to protect the individual.
As opposed to empowering the association,
yes,
which is what
definitely.
So much of
And right now, you see, the legislation has been lobbied for by the developers and by the realtors and by CAI and the lawyers. They love it. And if there is a legal confrontation, I, as an individual homeowner, have to go out and pay my own legal fees. And they get, not only are they going to be high, but I'm going to have a darned hard time finding a lawyer who will even take my case for any price because they prefer to take the side of the board because they know they can attach the association's money through the board. And they know the association ultimately, let's say the legal fees got totally out of sight, ultimately the association must assess its members to pay those legal fees.
And the associations, and just to add to what you've said, the associations or the boards who sit there and go, oh, that's okay, we've got insurance.
That's right. Well, and the board takes the attitude, well, we can do anything we want. We've got liability insurance, also paid for by the association members. We've got liability insurance. As long as we're acting in good faith, we can do anything we want to. And good faith often covers up stupidity.
And if you make a claim on that insurance, your premiums are going to go up.
That's right.
And nobody talks about that. They just say, oh, well, we've got insurance.
Yeah, right.
And some people are being special assessed to fund the increase in premiums. So that is an issue that I think needs to be kept on the forefront. You know, at one point in your book, you ask the question, how can some mature adults choose to live in such an environment? Have you figured out the answer to that
one
yet?
they don't choose to live in such an environment because they don't. They're fed the propaganda. They don't think that's what they're getting into. They don't realize it until they're there that they're in a can of worms that they don't want to be in.
We're almost out of time here, Georgia. We have a couple of minutes and. I want to give you, well, first of all, I want to say that we're talking to Georgia Hutton under Mushroom Clouds, brand new book, just out, Homeowners versus Homeowner Associations. You can get in touch with Georgia by emailing her, georgia5_2002@hotmail.com. And Georgia, what's your main message out here? What do you want the listeners to take away?
Well, the main message is that the whole concept of homeowners association is a flawed concept. It's not a democratic concept, and I think it's a flash in the pan phenomenon historically. I think that in the long run, these will fade into the sunset where they belong. Right now, it's still sunrise time with these homeowners associations. But ultimately, I don't think people are going to accept it as an answer in a democratic society.
So you're saying basically we've kind of debunked this carefree living and affordable living. I mean, that's kind of gone by the wayside.
Yes, it has.
That was pretty handily done. We've talked about some of the other problems in here. In associations, We've talked about what needs to be done. We've talked about a Bill of Rights. I think we've covered a lot of ground here, Georgia, and I think that you guys out there, you need to read this book. It's called Under Mushroom Clouds. There's some real gems in there, and I sort of threw a few of them out for you today during the show, but, you're going to have to read it for yourselves if you want to find the rest of it. Georgia, thank you so much for joining us today. I really enjoyed it.
Shu, thank you so much for inviting me to join you.
I thank you, and please, you're on the Commons. We'll be back here every Saturday, same time, same place. Stay tuned, stay free. On the Commons was produced by OTC Multimedia Productions. See y'all next week.